Chapter 32, Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 22 April 1848.
Lieutenant Little, said Captain Crozier, please pass the order to abandon ship.
Yes, Captain.
Little turned and shouted the order down the crowded deck. The other officers and surviving second mate were absent, so John Lane, the boatswain, picked up the order and bellowed it toward the bow. Thomas Johnson, the boatswain's mate, and the man who had administered the lashes to Hickey and the other two men in January, shouted the order down the open hatchway, before finally closing and battening down the scuttle. There was no one left below decks, of course. Crozier and Lieutenant Little had walked the ship stern to bow on each deck, looking into every compartment, from the cold boiler room with its banked furnaces, to the hold deck's empty coal scuttles, to the cramped but empty forward cable locker, and then up through the decks. On the orlop deck, they had checked that the spirit room and gunner's storeroom were empty of all muskets, shotguns, powder and shot. Only rows of cutlasses and bayonets remained in the racks overhead, gleaming coldly in the lantern light. Two officers had checked that all necessary clothing had been removed from the slop room over the past month and a half, and then gone on to the empty captain's storeroom and equally empty bread room. On the foredeck, Little and Crozier had looked into every cabin and berth, noticing how neat the officers had left their bunks and shelves and remaining possessions, then seeing the seamen's hammocks tucked up for the final time, their sea chests lightened but still in place, as if awaiting the call to supper. Going aft then to notice the missing books in the great room, where men had made their choices from the volumes and carried scores of them onto the ice with them. Finally, standing next to the huge stove that was absolutely cold for the first time in almost 3 years, Lieutenant Little and Captain Crozier had called again down the forward scuttle, making sure that no one had remained behind. They would do a head count above, but this was part of the protocol of abandoning ship. Then they had gone up on deck and left the scuttle open behind them. The men standing on deck now were not surprised by the order to abandon ship. They had been called up and assembled for it. There were only about 25 Terrors present this morning. The rest were at Terror Camp, 2 miles south of Victory Point, or sledging materials to the camp, or out hunting or reconnoitering near Terror Camp. An equal number of Erebuses waited below on the ice, standing near sledges and piles of gear, where the Erebus gear and supply tents had been pitched since the 1st of April, when that ship had been abandoned. Crozier watched his men file down the ice ramp, leaving the ship forever. Finally, only he and Little were left standing on the canted deck. The 50-some men on the ice below looked up at them with eyes almost made invisible under low-pulled Welsh wigs and above wool comforters, all squinting in the cold morning light.
"Go ahead, Edward," Crozier said softly. "Over the side with you."
The lieutenant saluted, lifted his heavy pack of personal possessions, and went down first the ladder and then the ice ramp to join the men below. Crozier looked around. The thin April sunlight illuminated a world of tortured ice, looming pressure ridges, countless seracs and blowing snow. Tugging the bill of his cap lower and squinting toward the east, he tried to record his feelings at the moment. Abandoning ship was the lowest point in any captain's life. It was an admission of total failure. It was, in most cases, the end of a long naval career. To most captains, many of Francis Crozier's personal acquaintance, it was a blow from which they would never recover. Crozier felt none of that despair. Not yet. More important to him at the moment was the blue flame of determination that still burned small but hot in his breast.
"I will live."
He wanted his men to survive, or at least as many as possibly could. If there was the slightest hope of any man from HMS Erebus or HMS Terror surviving and going home to England, Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier was going to follow that hope and not look back. He had to get the men off the ship, and then off the ice. Realizing that almost 50 sets of eyes were looking up at him, Crozier patted the gunwale a final time, scrambled down the ladder they'd set on the starboard side as the ship had begun to cant more steeply to port in recent weeks, and then walked down the well-worn ice ramp to the waiting men. Hoisting his own pack and stepping into line near the men in harness at the rearmost sledge, he looked up a final time at the ship and said, "She looks fine, doesn't she, Harry?"
"She does that, Captain," said Captain of the Foretop, Harry Pegler.
As good as his word, he and the top men had managed to steep all of the stored masts and restore the yards and rigging in the past 2 weeks, despite blizzards, low temperatures, lightning storms, surging ice pressures, and high winds. Ice gleamed everywhere on the now top-heavy ship's restored topmasts, spars, and rigging. She looked to Crozier as if she were bedecked in jewels. After the sinking of HMS Erebus on the last day of March, Crozier and Fitzjames had decided that even though Terra had to be abandoned soon, if they were to have any chance of walking or taking the boats to safety before winter, the ship should be restored to sailing shape. Should they be stuck at Terra Camp on King William Land for months into summer, and the ice miraculously open, they could, theoretically, take the boats back to Terra and try sailing to freedom. Theoretically.
"Mr. Thomas," he called to Robert Thomas, the second mate and lead hauler on the first of the five sledges. "Lead off, when you're ready."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
called back Thomas, and leaned into the harness. Even with seven men straining in harness, the sledge did not budge. The runners had frozen to the ice.
"Hearty does it, Bob,"
said Edwin Lawrence, laughing, one of the seamen in harness with him. The sledge groaned. Men groaned. Leather creaked. Ice tore, and the high-packed sledge moved forward. Lieutenant Little gave the order for the second sledge, headed up by Magnus Manson, to start off. With the giant in the lead of the men, the second sledge, although more heavily laden than Thomas's, immediately started off with only the slightest rasp of ice under the wooden runners. And so it went for the 46 men, 35 of them man-hauling for the first stretch, 5 walking in reserve with shotguns or muskets, waiting to pull, 4 of the mates from both ships and the 2 officers, Lieutenant Little and Captain Crozier, walking alongside and occasionally pushing, and less frequently slipping into harness themselves. The captain remembered that several days earlier, when 2nd Lieutenant Hodgson and 3rd Lieutenant Irving were preparing to leave for yet another boat sledge trip to Camp Terra, both officers then ordered to take men from that camp to hunt and reconnoitre over the next few days. Irving had surprised his captain by requesting that one or the other of 2 men assigned to his team be left back at Terra. Crozier had been initially surprised because his estimate of young John Irving had been that the junior lieutenant was capable of dealing with seamen and carrying out and enforcing any orders given to him. But then Crozier had heard the names involved and understood. Lieutenant Little had put the names of both Magnus Manson and Cornelius Hickey on Irving's sledge and scouting team rosters, and Irving was respectfully requesting, without giving any reasons, that one or the other man be assigned to another team. Crozier had acceded to the request immediately, reassigning Manson to the last day's sledge pulls and allowing the small Calker's mate to go ahead with Lieutenant Irving's sledge team. Crozier did not trust Hickey either, especially after the near mutiny weeks ago, and he knew that the little man was much more treacherous with the huge idiot Manson by his side. Now walking away from the ship, seeing Manson pulling 50 feet ahead of him, Crozier deliberately kept his face directed forward. He had resolved that he would not look back at Terra for at least the first 2 hours of the pulling. Looking at the men leaning and straining ahead of him, the captain was very aware of those who were absent. Fitzjames was absent this day, serving as commanding officer at Camp Terra on King William Land, but the real reason for his absence was tact. No captain wanted to abandon his ship in full view of another captain, if at all possible. And all captains were sensitive to this. Crozier, who had visited Erebus almost every day from the beginning of its breakup from ice pressure 2 days after the fire and invasion of the thing from the ice in early March, had made a point of not being there midday on 31 March, when Fitzjames had to abandon ship. Fitzjames had returned the favour this week by volunteering for command duties far from Terra. Most of the other men's absences were for a far more tragic and depressing reason. Crozier brought up their faces as he marched alongside the last sledge. Terra had been much luckier than Erebus when it came to loss of its officers and leaders. Of his primary officers, Crozier had lost his first mate, Fred Hornby, to the Beast during the Carnival debacle, Second Master Giles McBean to the Thing during the sledge trip the previous September, and both his surgeons, Peddy and MacDonald, also during the New Year's Eve Carnival. But his first, second and third lieutenants were alive and reasonably well, as was his second mate, Thomas, Blanky, his ice master, and the indispensable Mr. Helperman, his primary clerk. Fitzjames had lost his commanding officer, Sir John, and his first lieutenant, Graham Gore, as well as Lieutenant James Walter Fairholme and first mate Robert Orme Sargent, all killed by the creature. He'd also lost his primary surgeon, Mr. Stanley, and Henry Foster Collins, his second master. That left only Lieutenant H.T.D. Leveconte, second mate Charles Devoe, ice master Reed, Surgeon Goodsir, and his purser, Charles Hamilton Osmer, as his remaining complement of officers. Instead of the crowded officers' mess of the first 2 years, Sir John, Fitzjames, Gore, Leveconte, Fairholme, Stanley, Goodsir, and Clark Osmer all dining together, the final weeks had seen only the captain and his sole surviving lieutenant, the surgeon and clerk, dining in the cold of the officers' wardroom. And even that, in the last days, Crozier knew, had been an absurd sight, once the ice had tilted Erebus almost 30 degrees to starboard. The four men had been forced to sit on the deck, their plates on their knees and their feet braced hard against a batten. Hoare, Fitzjames's steward, was still sick with scurvy, so poor old Bridgens had been the steward scurrying like a crab to serve the officers braced on the wildly tilted deck. Terra had also been luckier in keeping her warrant officers intact. Crozier's engineer, Chief Boatswain and Carpenter were still alive and functioning. Erebus had seen her engineer John Gregory and her carpenter John Weeks both eviscerated in March when the Thing on the Ice had come aboard in the night. The ship's other warrant officer, Boatswain Thomas Terry, had been beheaded by the creature the previous November. Fitzjames had no warrant officers left alive. Of Terra's 21 petty officers, mates, quartermasters, forecastle, hold, maintop and foretop captains, coxswains, stewards, caulkers and stokers, Crozier had lost only one man, stoker John Torrington, the first man on the expedition to die, so long ago on 1 January 1846, way back at Beachy Island. And that, Crozier remembered, had been from consumption that young Torrington had brought aboard with him in England. Fitzjames had lost another of his petty officers, stoker Tommy Plater, on the day in March, when the Thing had gone on its murderous rampage on the lower decks. Only Thomas Watson, the carpenter's mate, had survived the Thing's attack down on the hold deck that night, and he had lost his left hand. Since Thomas Burt, the armourer, had been sent back to England from Greenland even before they'd encountered real ice, that left Erebus with 20 surviving petty officers. Some of these men, such as the ancient sailmaker John Murray and Fitzjames's own steward Edmund Hoare, were too sick with scurvy to be useful, while others, such as Thomas Watson, were too mauled to be of help, while still others, such as the flogged gunroom steward Richard Aylmore, were too sullen to be of much use. Crozier told one of the men, who was obviously fagged out, to take a break and to walk with the armed guard, while he, the captain, took a turn in the harness. Even with six other men pulling, the terrible exertion of hauling more than 1,500 pounds of canned food, weapons and tents was a strain on his weakened system. Even after Crozier fell into the rhythm, he'd joined sledging parties since March, when he first began dispatching boats and gear to King William Land, and well knew the drill of man-hauling, the pain of the straps across his aching chest, the weight of the mass being pulled, and the discomfort from sweat that froze, thawed and refroze in his clothes were all a shock. Crozier wished they had more able-bodied seamen and marines. Terra had lost two of its rated sailors, Billy Strong, torn in half by the creature, and James Walker, the idiot Magnus Manson's good friend, before the giant fell completely under the sway of the little rat-faced caulker's mate. It had been fear of Jimmy Walker's ghost in the hold, Crozier remembered, that had brought the hulking Manson to his first point of mutiny so many months ago. For once, HMS Erebus had been luckier than its counterpart. The only able seaman FitzJames had lost during this expedition had been John Hartnell, also dead of consumption and buried in the winter of 46 on Beachy Island. Crozier leaned into the straps and thought about the faces and names. So many officers dead, so few regular sailors, and grunted as he pulled, thinking that the thing on the ice seemed to be deliberately coming after the leaders of this expedition.
Don't think that way, Crozier ordered himself. You're giving the beast powers of reasoning that it doesn't have.
Doesn't it? Asked another, more fearful part of Crozier's mind. One of the Royal Marines walked by, carrying a musket rather than shotgun in the crook of his arm. The man's face was completely hidden by caps and wraps, but from the slouched way the man walked, Crozier knew that it was Robert Hopcraft. The Marine private had been seriously injured by the creature on the day a year ago in June when Sir John was killed, but while Hopcraft's other injuries had healed, his shattered collarbone left him always slouching to his left, as if he had trouble maintaining a straight line. Another Marine walking with them was William Pilkington, the private who had been shot through his shoulder in the blind that same day. Crozier noticed that Pilkington didn't seem to be favouring that shoulder or arm today. Sergeant David Bryant, Erebus's ranking Marine, was decapitated just seconds before Sir John had been carried off under the ice by the beast. With Private William Brain dead on Beachy Island in 1846, and Private William Reed disappeared on the ice on 9 November of last fall while sent to deliver a message to Terror, Crozier remembered the date well, since he had walked to Erebus from Terror in the dark himself that first full day of winter darkness. The beast had reduced FitzJames's Marine Guard to only 4. Corporal Alexander Pearson in command, Private Hopcraft with his ruined shoulder, Private Pilkington with his bullet wound, and Private Joseph Healy. Crozier's own Marine detachment had lost only Private William Heather to the thing on the ice on the night the previous November when the creature had come aboard and bashed the man's brains out while the private was on watch. But amazingly, shockingly, Heather had refused to die. After lying comatose in the sick bay for weeks, obscenely hovering between life and death, Private Heather had been carried by his Marine mates to his hammock forward in the crew berthing area, and they had fed him and cleaned him and carried him to the seat of ease and dressed him every day since. It was as if the staring, drooling man was their pet. He'd been evacuated to Terror Camp just last week, bundled up warmly by the other Marines and set carefully, almost royally, into a special one-man toboggan made for him by Alex Fat Wilson, the carpenter's mate. The seamen had not objected to the extra load and had volunteered to take turns pulling the living corpse's little sled across the ice and over the pressure ridges to Terror Camp. That left Crozier 5 Marines, Daly, Hammond, Wilkes, Hedges, and 37-year-old Sergeant Solomon Tozer, an unschooled fool but now commanding officer among the total of 9 functional surviving Royal Marines on the Sir John Franklin Expedition. After the first hour in harness, the sledge seemed to slide more easily, and Crozier had fallen into the rhythm of panting that passed for breathing while hauling such dead weight across such non-slippery ice. That was all the categories of men lost that Crozier could think of, except for the boys, of course, those young volunteers who had signed on to the expedition at the last minute and had been listed on the roster as boys, even though 3 of the 4 were a full-grown 18 years old. Robert Golding was 19 when they sailed. 3 of the 4 boys survived, although Crozier himself had been forced to carry the unconscious George Chambers from the burning Carnival compartments on the night of the fire. The only fatality among the boys had been Tom Evans, the youngest in demeanour as well as in age. The thing on the ice had plucked the lad literally from beneath Captain Crozier's nose as they were out on the ice in the dark, hunting for the missing William Strong. George Chambers, although recovering consciousness 2 days after Carnival, had never been the same. A bright lad before his violent encounter with the thing, the concussion he received reduced him to a level of intelligence even below that of Magnus Manson. George was no living corpse like Private Heather. He could obey simple orders, according to Erebus's bosun's mate, but he hardly ever spoke after that terrible New Year's Eve. David Lays, one of the more experienced men on the expedition, was another man who had physically survived 2 encounters with the white thing on the ice, but who was as useless as the literally brainless Private Heather these days. After the night, the White Thing encountered Lays and John Hanford on watch, and then chased Ice Master Thomas Blanky into the darkness. Lays had slipped back into his earlier state of unresponsive staring, and had never returned from it. He had been transported to Terror Camp. Along with the seriously injured, or those too ill to walk, such as Fitzjames's steward Hoare, bundled in coats and tucked into one of the boats being dragged atop a sledge. There were too many men now sick with scurvy, wounds, or low morale who were of little use to Crozier or Fitzjames. More mouths to feed and bodies to haul with them when the men were hungry and sick and barely able to walk. Weary, realizing that he had not really slept in the past 2 nights, Crozier tried counting the dead. 6 officers from Erebus, 4 dead from Terra. All 3 warrant officers from Erebus, 0 from Terra. 1 petty officer from Erebus, 1 from Terra. Just 1 seaman from Erebus, 4 from Terra. That was 20 dead, not counting the 3 Marines and the boy Evans. 24 men lost on the expedition already. A frightful loss, greater than Crozier could remember from any Arctic expedition in naval history. But there was a more important number, and one that Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier tried to focus on. 105 living souls remaining under his care. 105 men alive, including himself on this day he had been forced to abandon HMS Terra and cross the ice. Crozier put his head down and leaned more into the harness. The wind had come up and was blowing snow around them, obscuring the sledge ahead, hiding the walking Marines from sight. Was he sure in the count? 20 dead, not counting the 3 Marines and 1 boy? Yes, he was certain that he and Lieutenant Little had checked the muster that morning and confirmed 105 men spread out between the sledging parties, Terra Camp, and HMS Terra that morning. But was he certain? Had he forgotten anyone? Was his addition and subtraction correct? Crozier was very, very tired. Francis Crozier might get muddled in the count for a short while. He had not slept at all in 3 nights. But he had not forgotten a single man's face or name, nor would he ever.
Captain!
Crozier came out of the trance that he fell into when he was man-hauling sledges. He could not have told anyone at this moment whether he had been in harness an hour or 6 hours. The world had become the glare of the cold sun in the southeastern sky, the blowing ice crystals, the rack of his breath, the pain of his body, the shared weight behind him, the resistance of the sea ice and new snow, and most of all the oddly blue sky, with wisps of white clouds curling around on all sides, as if they were all walking in a blue and white rimmed bowl.
Captain!
It was Lieutenant Little shouting. Crozier realized that his fellow pullers had come to a halt. All of the sledges were stopped on the ice. Ahead of them, to the southeast, perhaps a mile beyond the next heaped ice pressure ridge, a 3-masted ship was moving north to south. Its sails were furled and shrouded, its yards rigged for anchorage, but it moved anyway, as if on a strong current, gliding slowly and majestically on what must be a wide avenue of open water, just beyond the next high ridge. Rescue! Salvation! The steady blue flame of hope in Crozier's aching chest flared brighter for a few exhilarating seconds. Ice Master Thomas Blanky, his peg leg set into something rather like a wooden boot that Carpenter Honey had devised, stepped up to Crozier and said,
"A mirage!"
"Of course," said the captain. He'd recognized the distinctive bomb ship masts and rigging of HMS Terra almost immediately, even through the shimmering, shifting air, and for a few seconds of confusion bordering on vertigo, Crozier had wondered if somehow they had managed to get lost, turned around, and were actually heading back to the northwest toward the ship they'd abandoned hours earlier. No, there were the old sledge tracks, drifted over in spots but deeply worn into the ice by more than a month's repeated passage back and forth, heading straight for the tall pressure ridge with its narrow passes hacked out with picks and shovels. And the sun was still ahead of them and to their right, deep in the south. Beyond the pressure ridge, the 3 masts shimmered, dissolved briefly, and then returned more solidly than ever, only upside down, with the hull of the ice-entombed Terror blending into a white cirrus sky. Crozier and Blanky, and so many of the others, had seen this phenomenon many times before. False things in the sky. Years ago, on a fine winter morning, frozen in off the coast of the landmass they were calling Antarctica, Crozier had seen a smoking volcano, the very one named after this ship, rising upside down from solid sea to the north. Another time, on this very expedition, in the spring of 1847, Crozier had come on deck to find black spheres floating in the southern sky. The spheres turned into solid figure eights, then divided again into what looked like a symmetrical progression of ebony balloons, and then, within the course of a quarter hour, evaporated completely. Two seamen on the third sledge had literally dropped in their traces and were on their knees in the rutted snow. One man was weeping loudly, and the other had unleashed a string of the most imaginative sailor curses Crozier had ever heard, and the captain had heard his fill over the decades.
"God damn it," shouted Crozier. "You've seen Arctic mirages before. Belay that snivelling and cursing, or you'll be man-hauling that goddamn sledge by yourselves, and I'll be sitting on it with one boot up each of your arses. Get on your feet, by God. You're men, not weak sisters. Fucking act like it."
The two seamen got to their feet and clumsily brushed off ice, crystals, and snow. Crozier couldn't immediately identify them by their slops and Welsh wigs, and he did not want to. The line of sledges started up again, with much grunting, but no cursing. Everyone knew that the high-pressure ridge ahead of them, carved out as it had been by countless previous trips in the past weeks, was still going to be a Christ-fucking-cob. They would have to lift and wrestle the heavy sledges up at least 15 feet of steep incline between the perilous 60-foot ice cliffs on either side. The threat of tumbling ice boulders would be very real then.
"It's as if there's some dark god who wants to torment us," Thomas Blanky said almost cheerily.
The Ice Master had no pulling duties and was still stumping alongside Crozier. The captain did not respond to this, and after a minute Blanky fell back to stump along beside one of the outriding marines. Crozier called for one of the extra men to take his place in harness, something they had rehearsed doing without stopping the forward motion of the sledges, and when the extra hand took over, he stepped aside out of the ruts and checked his watch. They had been pulling about 5 hours. Looking behind, Crozier saw that the real Terror had been out of sight for some time, at least 5 miles and several low-pressure ridges behind them. The mirage image had been a final offering from some evil Arctic god that seemed intent on tormenting them all. Still leader of this ill-fated expedition, Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier realized for the first time that he was no longer captain of a ship in Her Majesty's Royal Navy Discovery Service. That part of his life, and being a seaman and naval officer had been his life since he was a boy, was over forever. After being responsible for losing so many men and both his ships, he knew the Admiralty would never give him another command. In terms of his long naval career, Crozier knew he was now a dead man walking. There were still 2 hard days of man-hauling away from Terror Camp. Crozier fixed his gaze on the tall pressure ridge ahead and trudged forward. Chapter 33. Good Sir. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 22 April, 1848. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir.
22 April, 1848. I have been 4 days at this place we are calling Terror Camp. I believe it lives up to its name. Captain Fitzjames is in charge of 60 men here, including myself. I confess that when I first sledged within sight of the place last week, the first image that came to mind was something out of Homer's Iliad. The camp is set along the edge of a wide inlet about 2 miles south of a cairn raised almost 2 decades ago at Victory Point by James Clark Ross. It is somewhat more sheltered from the wind and snow blowing off the ice pack here. Perhaps scenes from the Iliad were evoked by the 18 long boats pulled up in a row by the edge of the sea ice, four boats lying on their sides in the gravel, the other 14 boats tied upright on sledges. Behind the boats are 20 tents, ranging in size from the small Holland tents of the design we used almost a year ago when I accompanied the late Lieutenant Gore to Victory Point. Each Holland tent is large enough for 6 men to sleep in, 3 per bag, in the 5-foot-wide wolfskin blanket robe sleeping bags, to the somewhat larger tents made by the sailmaker Murray, including tents meant for Captain Fitzjames and Captain Crozier and their personal stewards, and the largest 2 tents, each roughly the size of the great cabins on Erebus and Terror, one serving as sick bay, the other as the seaman's mess tent. There are other mess tents for warrant officers, petty officers, and the officers and their civilian counterparts, such as Engineer Thompson and myself. Or perhaps the Iliad was evoked because when one approaches Terror Camp at night, and all of the sledging parties coming from HMS Terror to the camp arrived after dark on their third day, one is first struck by the number of bonfires and campfires. There is no wood to burn, of course, except for some spare oak brought from the crushed Erebus precisely for that purpose, but many of the last remaining sacks of coal had been ferried across the ice from the ships over the past month, and many of these coal fires were burning when I first saw Terror Camp. Some were in fire rings made from rocks, some were in 4 of the tall braziers, salvaged from the Carnival fire. The effect was flames and light, added to by the occasional torch and lantern. After spending several days in Terror Camp, I have decided that the place more resembles a pirate encampment than any camp of Achilles, Odysseus, Agamemnon, and the other Homeric heroes. The men's clothes are ragged, frayed, and many times repaired. Most are ill or limping or both. Their faces are pale under sometimes thick beards. Their eyes stare out of sunken sockets. They swagger or stagger around with their boat knives dangling from crude belts set around their outer slops in clanking sheaths made from cut-down bayonet scabbards. It was Captain Crozier's idea, as were the goggles improvised from wire mesh that the men wear on sunny days to safeguard them from sun blindness. The overall effect is one of a ragtag group of ruffians. And most now show signs of scurvy. I have been very busy in the sickbay tent. The sledge teams had spent the extra energy to haul a dozen cots with them across the ice and over the frightful pressure ridges, plus 2 more cots for their captain's tents. But at the moment I have 20 men in sickbay, so 8 are on blanket pallets set onto the cold ground itself. 3 oil lamps provide us with illumination during the long nights. Most of the men sleeping in the sick bay have collapsed from scurvy, but not all. Sergeant Heather is back in my care, complete with the gold sovereign Dr. Peddy had screwed into his skull to replace the bone dashed out with some of his brains by the thing from the ice. The Marines have been taking care of Heather for months, and planned to continue to do so here at Terror Camp. The sergeant was transported here in his own little sled, designed by Mr. Honey, but a possible chill during the 3 days and nights of the crossing has brought on pneumonia. This time I do not expect the Marine sergeant, who has been a disturbing miracle of survival, to survive much longer. Also here is David Lays, whom his crewmates call Davy. His catatonic condition has not changed in months, but after the crossing this week, he came across with my group. He has not been able to keep down even the thinnest gruel or water. Today is Saturday. I do not expect Lays to be alive by this time Wednesday. Due to the great exertion of hauling the boats and so much materiel from the ship to the island, over pressure ridges I had trouble climbing even when not in man-hauling harness. There were the usual complement of bruises and broken bones for me to deal with. These included one serious compound fracture of Seaman Bill Shanks's arm. I have kept the man here after setting the bones for fear of sepsis. The flesh and skin were punctured by sharp bone fragments in 2 places. But scurvy remains the primary killer lurking in this tent. Mr. Hoare, Captain Fitzjames's personal steward, may well be the first man to die of it here. He is no longer conscious for much of the day. As with Lays and Heather, he had to be man-hauled across the 25 miles separating our doomed ship from this Terror Camp. Edmund Hoare is an early but typical example of the progression of this disease. The captain's steward is a young man. He will turn 27 in a little more than 2 weeks on May 9. if he survives that long. For a steward, Hoare is a large man, 6 feet tall, and to all appearances, to Chief Surgeon Stanley and myself, he was in fine health when the expedition sailed. He was quick, smart, alert, energetic in his duties, and unusually athletic for a steward. During the running and man-hauling games, held so frequently on the ice at Beachy Island in the winter of 1845-46, Hoare was frequently a winner and leader of his various teams. He has had slight symptoms of the scurvy since last autumn, the weariness, lassitude, increasingly frequent confusion, but the disease became most pronounced after the debacle of the Venetian Carnival. He continued serving Captain Fitzjames 16 hours a day and more into February, but finally his health broke down. The first symptom to make itself known with Mr. Hoare is what the men in the forecastle are calling the crown of thorns. Blood began weeping from Edmund Hoare's hair, and not just from the hair on his head. First his caps, and then his undershirts, and then his underthings became stained with blood each day. I have observed this carefully, and the blood on the scalp does come from the follicles themselves. Some of the seamen attempted to avoid this early symptom by shaving their heads, but of course this does no good. With Welsh wigs, caps, scarves, and now pillows being soaked with blood by the majority of the men, the sailors and officers have begun wearing towels under their headgear and laying their head on them at night. This does not, of course, alleviate the embarrassment and discomfort of bleeding from all points that have body hair. Hemorrhages began appearing under Steward Hoare's skin in January. Although the outside games were a distant memory by then, and Mr. Hoare's duties rarely took him far from the ship or into great physical exertion, the slightest bump or bruise would show on his body as a massive red and blue blotch. It would not heal. A scratch from peeling potatoes or carving beef would stay open and continue to bleed for weeks. By late January, Mr. Hoare's legs had swollen to twice their normal size. He had to borrow filthy trousers from larger crewmen just to stay dressed while serving his captain. He could not sleep because of the ever-increasing pain in his joints. By early March, any movement at all was agony for Edmund Hoare. All through March, Hoare insisted that he could not stay in Erebus's sick bay, that he had to return to his berth and to serving and caring for Captain Fitzjames. His blonde hair was constantly soaked with caked blood. His swollen arms, legs, and face began to look like pasty dough. Every day that I tested his skin, it had lost more elasticity. By the week before Erebus was crushed, I could push deep into Edmund Hoare's flesh, and the dimple would stay there permanently, the new bruise spreading and spilling into a patchwork of earlier hemorrhages. By mid-April, Hoare's entire body had become a bloated, misshapen mass. His face and hands were yellow from jaundice. His eyes were a bright yellow, made all the more shocking due to the bleeding from his eyebrows. Despite my assistance and my own efforts to turn and move the patient several times a day, by the day we carried him from the dying Erebus, Hoare was covered with bedsores that had become brownish-purple ulcers that never ceased suppurating. His face, especially on either side of his nose and mouth, was also ulcerated, constantly oozing pus and blood. Pus from a scurvy victim has an extraordinarily foul stench. By the day we moved Mr. Hoare to Terror Camp, he had lost all but two of his teeth, and this was a man who, on Christmas Day, had boasted the healthiest smile of any young man on the expedition. Hoare's gums have blackened and receded. He is conscious only a few hours each day and is in terrible pain during every second of that time. When we open his mouth to feed him, the stench is close to unbearable. Since we cannot wash towels, we have lined his cot with sailcloth, which is now black with blood. His frozen and filthy clothing is also brittle with dried blood and crusted pus. As terrible as his appearance and suffering are, the more terrible fact is that Edmund Hoare may linger on like this, getting worse each day, for more weeks or even months. Scurvy is an insidious killer. It tortures for a long time before it grants its victim a final peace. By the time one dies of scurvy, one's closest relative often will not be able to recognize the sufferer, and not enough of the sufferer's mind will be left to recognize the relative. But that is not a problem here. With the exception of brothers serving together on this expedition, and Thomas Hartnell lost his oldest brother on Beachy Island, There are no relatives who will ever come out here on the ice or onto this terrible island of wind, snow, ice, lightning and fog. There is no one to identify us when we fall, much less bury us. 12 of the men in the sick bay are dying of scurvy, and more than 2/3 of the 105 survivors, including myself, have one or more symptoms of it. We will be out of the lemon juice, our most successful antisorbutic, although its efficacy has been declining steadily the past year in less than a week. The only defense I will have then is vinegar. A week ago in the store's tent on the ice outside HMS Terra, I personally presided over the decanting of our remaining volumes of vinegar from casks to be proportioned out into 18 smaller kegs, one for each boat that had been sledged to Terra Camp. The men hate vinegar. Unlike the lemon juice, whose tartness can be somewhat disguised with dollops of sugar water or even rum, vinegar tastes like poison to men whose palates have already been damaged by the scurvy growing in their systems. Officers, who have dined more on Goldner's canned foods than the seamen have, they ate their beloved, although rancid, salted pork and beef until those casks were empty, appear to be more prone to coming down with the advanced symptoms of scurvy than the regular sailors. This confirms Dr. MacDonald's theory that there is some vital element lacking, or some poison present, in the purely canned meats and vegetables and soups, as opposed to spoiled but once fresh victuals. If there was some miraculous way I could discover that element, poison or lifesaver, I would not only have a good chance of saving these men, possibly even Mr. Hoare, but would run an excellent chance of being knighted when we are rescued or reach safe harbour by ourselves. But there is no way to do it, given our current conditions and my lack of any scientific apparatus. The best I can do is insist that the men eat any fresh meat that our hunters shoot and bring in, even the blubber and sweetmeats. I feel, against all logic, may strengthen us against scurvy. But our hunters have found no living things to shoot, and the ice is too thick to chop through for fishing. Last night, Captain Fitzjames stopped by, as he does at the beginning and end of each of his long, long days, and after he had his usual rounds of the sleeping men, asking me the changes in condition of each, I was forward enough to ask him the question I had been wondering about for so many weeks now. "Captain," I said, "I understand if you are too busy to answer this, or if you prefer not to, since it is a lubber's question. There is no doubt of it, but I've been wondering for some time, why 18 boats? We seem to have brought every boat from Erebus and Terra, yet we have only 105 men." Captain Fitzjames said, "Come outside with me if you will, Dr. Goodsir." I told Henry Lloyd, my weary assistant, to watch over the men, and followed Captain Fitzjames outside. I had noticed in the sickbay tent that his beard, which I had thought was coming in red, was actually mostly grey, only rimmed in dried blood. The captain had brought an extra lantern from the sickbay, and he led the way with it down to the gravelled beach. There was no wine-dark sea lapping at the shingle of this beach, of course. Instead, the heap of coastal tall bergs that formed a barrier between us and the ice pack still lined the shore. Captain Fitzjames raised his lantern along the long line of boats. "What do you see, Doctor?" he asked. "Boats?" I ventured, feeling every inch the lubber I had accused myself of being. "Can you tell the difference between them, Dr. Goodsir?" I looked more carefully in the lantern light. "These first four are not on sledges," I said. I had been quick to notice that, even the first night I was here. I had no idea why this was the case, when Mr. Honey had gone to such care to make special sledges for all the rest. It seemed like rank carelessness to me. "Ah, you are correct," said Captain Fitzjames. "These four are our whaleboats from Erebus and Terra. 30 feet long, lighter than the others, very strong. 6 oars each, double-ended like canoes. Do you see now?" I did now. I had never noticed that the whaleboats seemed to have 2 bows, like a canoe. "If we had 10 whaleboats, continued the captain, everything would have been perfect." "Why is that?" I asked. "They're strong, Doctor. Very strong and light, as I said. And we could pile supplies in them and drag them across the ice without having had the need to build sledges as we did for the others. If we find open water, we could launch them straight from the ice." I shook my head. Knowing that Captain Fitzjames would think me a total fool as soon as I asked the question, I asked it anyway. But why can the whaleboats be dragged on the ice when the others cannot, Captain? Captain Fitzjames's voice showed no impatience when he said, "Do you see the rudder, Doctor?" I looked at each end, but I did not. I confessed that to the captain. "Exactly," he said. "Whaleboats have a shallow keel and no fixed rudder. An oarsman at the stern steers her." "Is that good?" I asked. "It is if you want a light, tough boat with a shallow keel and no tender rudder to be broken off when you're dragging her," said Captain Fitzjames. "Perfect for man-hauling across the ice, even though she's 30 feet long and can carry up to 12 men with room for supplies." I nodded as if I understood. I almost did, but I was very tired. "Do you see her mast, Doctor?" Again I looked. Again I failed to find that which had been requested of me to find. I admitted as much. "That's because the whaleboats have a single collapsible mast," said the captain. "It's there, folded under the canvas the men have rigged over her gunwales." "I have noticed that canvas and wood covering all the boats," I said, to show that I was not totally unobservant. "Is that to keep the snow out?" Fitzjames was lighting his pipe. He had run out of tobacco long ago. I did not want to know what he was burning in it. "The boat covers were put on to shield the crews of all 18 boats, even though we may only take 10 boats with us," he said softly. Most of the men in camp were sleeping. Guards paced coldly just at the edge of the lantern light. "We'll be under that canvas when we cross open water to the mouth of the Back's Great Fish River?" I asked. I had never pictured us hunkered down under canvas and wood. I had always imagined us rowing happily in sunlight. "We may not use the boats on the river," he said, puffing out aromatic clouds of what smelled like dried human excrement. "If the waters along the coast open up this summer, Captain Crozier would prefer us to sail to safety." "All the way to Alaska and St. Petersburg?" I asked. "To Alaska at least," said the captain. "Or perhaps Baffin Bay if the coastal leads open to the north." He took several steps and swung the lantern closer to the boats on sledges. "Do you know these boats, Doctor? Are they different, Captain?" I found that such terrible fatigue was a great inducement to honesty without embarrassment. "Aye," said Fitzjames. "These next two lashed to Mr. Honey's special sledges here are our cutters. Surely you noticed them when they were lashed on deck or on the ice next to the ships these past 3 winters. "Yes, of course," I said. "But are you saying these are different from the first, the whaleboats?" "Quite different," said Captain Fitzjames, taking the time to relight his pipe. "Do you notice any masts on these boats, Doctor?" Even in the dim light from the lantern, I could see 2 masts rising from each of these craft. The canvas had been artfully shaped and cut and stitched around them. I told the captain my observation. "Aye, very good," he said. He did not sound condescending. "Are these collapsible masts not collapsed for a purpose?" I asked, as much to show that I had been listening earlier as for any better reason. "They are not collapsible, Dr. Good Sir. These masts are lug-rigged, or you may know them as gaff-rigged. Quite permanent. And do you see the fixed rudder on these, and the deeper keels?" "I could. I did. The rudders and keels are the reason they could not be dragged like the whaleboats," I ventured. "Exactly. You have diagnosed the problem, Doctor. Could not the rudders be removed, Captain?" "Possibly, Dr. Good Sir, but the deep keels, they would have been stuck or ripped out by the first pressure ridge now, wouldn't they?" I nodded again and laid my mittened hand on the gunwale. "Is it my imagination, or are these 4 boats slightly shorter than the whaleboats?" "You have a very good eye indeed, Doctor. 28 feet long as opposed to 38 feet for the whaleboats. And heavier. The cutters are heavier and square-sterned." For the first time, I noticed that these 2 boats, unlike the whalers, definitely had a bow and a squared-off stern. No canoes here. "How many men will the cutters carry?" I asked. 10, and they pull 8 oars. "They have room for quite a few stores, and there will be room for us all to huddle down out of the storm, even on the open sea. And with the 2 masts, the cutters will offer twice the canvas to the wind that the whaleboats do, but the cutters will not be as good as the whalers if we have to go up Back's Great Fish River. Why is that? I asked, feeling that I should already know, that he had already told me. The deeper draught, sir. Let us look at the next two, the jolly boats. I found nothing jolly-looking about either of the next two boats. They seem longer than the cutters, I said. They are, Doctor. 30 feet long apiece, the same length as our whaleboats. But heavier, Doctor, heavier even than the cutters. A great trial with their 900-pound sledges to haul across the ice, even this far, I assure you. Captain Crozier may choose to leave them here. I asked, then should we not have left them behind at the ships? He shook his head. No. We need to choose which boats will best serve to allow 100 men to survive for several weeks or months at sea, or even on the river. Did you know that boats, all of these boats, have to be rigged differently for sailing on the sea or catching the wind going up river, Doctor? It was my turn to shake my head. No matter, said Captain Fitzjames. We'll get into the niceties of river rigging versus sea rigging some other time, preferably on a sunny, warm day far south of here. These last 8 boats, the first 2 are pinnaces, the next 4 are ship's boats, and the final 2 are dinghies. The dinghies seem much shorter, I said. Captain Fitzjames puffed on his literally execrable pipe and nodded as if I had revealed some pearl of wisdom from Holy Scripture. Aye, he said sadly. The dinghies are only 12 feet long, as opposed to the pinnaces' 28-foot length and the ship's boats 22 feet. But none of them can be rigged for masts and sailing, and they're all lightly oared. The men in these boats would be in for some hard times if we went to the open sea, I am afraid. I would not be surprised if Captain Crozier chooses to leave them behind. I thought, open sea? The idea of actually sailing any of these craft on anything more expansive than Back's Great Fish River, which I imagined rather like the Thames, had never occurred to me before tonight, even though I had been present at various war councils discussing such possibilities. It seemed to me, looking at the smaller and rather delicate-looking dinghies and ships' boats lashed on their sledges, that the men going to sea in these would be doomed to watch the pinnaces with their 2 masts and the whaleboats with their single tall masts simply sail away over the horizon. The men in these smaller boats would be doomed. How would the crews be chosen? Had they been chosen already, in secret, by the 2 captains? And which boat and which fate had I been assigned? If we take the smaller boats, we'll draw lots for them, said the captain. The places in the pinnaces, jolly boats and whale boats, would be assigned according to man-hauling teams. I must have looked at him in alarm. Captain Fitzjames laughed. A laugh that turned into a racking cough and knocked out the ashes from his pipe against his boot. The wind was coming up, and it was very cold. I had no idea of the time, some time after midnight. It had been dark for at least 7 hours. Don't worry, Doctor, he said softly. I wasn't reading your mind, only your expression. As I say, we'll draw lots for the smaller boats, but we may not take the smaller boats. In either case, we won't leave anyone behind. We'll tie the ships together in the open water. I smiled at this, hoping that the captain could see my smile in the lantern light, but not my bleeding gums. I didn't know that ships under sail could be tied to other ships not under sail, I said, showing my ignorance again. Most of the time they cannot, said Captain Fitzjames. He touched me lightly on the back, a touch I could hardly feel through my outer slops. Now that you've learned the nautical secrets of all 18 boats that might end up in our little fleet, Doctor, shall we get back? It's rather cold and I have to get some sleep before I rise at 4 bells to check on the watch. I bit my lip, tasting blood. I do have one last question, Captain, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
When will Captain Crozier choose the boat we take, and when will he put those boats in the water? I said. My voice was very hoarse. The captain moved slightly and was silhouetted against the light from the bonfire near the seaman's mess tent. I could not see his face. I don't know, Dr. Goodsir, he said at last. I doubt if Captain Crozier could tell you. Lady Luck may be with us, and the ice may break up in a few weeks. If it does, I'll sail you to Baffin Island myself. or we could be launching some of these craft against the current at the mouth of the Great Fish River in 3 months. Conceivably, there could still be time to get to Great Slave Lake and the outpost there before winter fully sets in, even if it takes until July to reach the river. He patted the curved side of the pinnace closest to him. I felt a strange, quiet pride in being able to identify it as a pinnace. Or perhaps it was one of the two jolly boats. I tried not to think of the condition of Edmund Hoare and what it forecast for all the rest of us if we did not begin the 850-mile venture up Back's River, the river they also called the Great Fish River, for another 3 months. Who could possibly be left alive if a boat made it to Great Slave Lake months later than that? Or, he said softly, if Lady Luck is not with us, these hulls and keels may never feel water under them again. There was nothing to say to that. It was our death sentence. I turned from the light to walk back to the sickbay tent. I respected Captain James Fitzjames, and I did not want him to see my face at that moment. Captain Fitzjames's hand fell on my shoulder, stopping me. "Should that be the case," he said, his voice fierce, "we'll just have to bloody well walk home, shan't we?"